Accession number 29424, reel 11.
Paul Oestreicher, reel 11. Paul, I wonder if we could now come to 9/11 and your reaction to this and what difference you think it has made to the world.
I think it's actually made less difference to the world than a lot of other things in history. Clearly, the trauma that many nations have experienced throughout the 20th century is a trauma the American people never experienced. War never touched America. Americans were involved, but always at some distance from their own shores. And the fact that the one and only superpower that we have at the moment, though that won't last very long, I think, historically, suddenly to find itself attacked on its own soil has traumatized Americans who, in any case, don't have a very high threshold when it comes to accepting the unacceptable. The stiff upper lip that's part of British life is not part of American life. Everything is taken in a way that certainly British people might see as rather hysterical. And so it's not a surprise that America has vastly overreacted to what was, of course, technologically a very successful attack. There is no doubt that the sheer intelligence of this attack is quite amazing. But when you come to think in terms of the damage it's done to America, it's minimal. There are more people, far, far more people every year killed on American roads than were killed in 9/11. And yet this is has become part of the modern society. So the fact that the president then honors his enemies by declaring war on them was probably one of the greatest mistakes ever made. Yes, the tragedy of religious fundamentalism, not just of Islamic fundamentalism, but of all forms of intolerant religion, can of course be harnessed to modern technology. Hitler did it by gassing people. The Americans began the process by obliterating two cities with two bombs. In other words, the individual life no longer counts. The ideology is what matters. So Hitler did it one way. The Americans began the nuclear age by wiping out two whole cities. So why should not, by those standards, Islamic fanatics, because that's surely what they are, decide to do exactly the same thing as best they can? And they demonstrated that they can do it fairly well. Having said that, I still have to put in parenthesis that the conspiracy theories are not entirely inconceivable. In other words, is this what it seems to be, or is there something else behind it that history might uncover one day? I had the extraordinary experience of being in a German restaurant a few days after 9/11, and all the tables were taken. And so I stood there looking a little bit lost with my wife, and one man was sitting alone at his table, and he beckoned to us and said, "Would you like to share my table?" So of course we did. And it turns out that he was a Lufthansa pilot, regularly piloting long-distance planes of the very type that flew into these buildings. Now, he wasn't giving us a political lecture or engaging in a conspiracy theory, but he said, I have thought very hard. I know, of course, how sophisticated this technology is, and that for two planes within a few minutes of each other to coordinate and crash into one building can only be done by the most sophisticated use of the technology that steers those planes and coordinates them. It's computerized. It's not just a matter of flying a plane. It's far more complicated than that. And I cannot conceive how people who allegedly had just briefly learnt to fly planes in Florida, which is the American version, that they went to flying school in Florida in order to learn to fly these planes. He said they could not possibly have done what they did. Only those who have flown long-distance planes for a long time and have detailed knowledge of how to work the technology could possibly have coordinated this. I cannot understand it. Now, of course, it is conceivable that this is not what it seems to be, but let us assume that it is what it seems to be. And if it is, it is simply a sign that the 20th century's lack of respect for human life and putting ideology, putting one's so-called principles before the needs of people makes it possible, of course, to destroy on a very large scale. And 9/11 was an attempt to do that on a relatively small scale, although two buildings were a great shock to the American people. We know for certain that certain kinds of Islam have a crusading philosophy, which is much like the crusading philosophy that a lot of Christians have had in the past, only they haven't had access to that kind of technology, that they do want to win. But to declare on war on an idea that is a global idea makes it possible then to create the kind of hysteria in vast numbers of people that then enables those in power to manipulate and to withdraw the normal liberal human rights that American people had begun to take for granted, that we begin to take for granted in Britain, and that are no longer secure. If we have to go to the extent that the United States now goes in securing its territory and withdrawing human rights from everybody who might conceivably be an enemy, where it's no longer nation against nation, but idea against idea, so that in the end, the policing of our ideas can lead to a new tyranny. So in fact, if Al-Qaeda is the kind of threat that it is said it is, then if you declare this kind of war, you're actually giving them victory. You're actually declaring that they have incredible power, which simply on grounds of their numbers and so on, they don't have. So I think the task really is to calm down and say, this is what the world has always been like, but this should now teach us that modern technology, the technology of killing, in which nations have invested so much money, is accessible to all people. And unless far more efforts are now made to control the use of technology for destructive purposes, we could say our little planet is steering towards its own demise, that we now have it within our power so easily to destroy ourselves. And if we don't learn that from the history of the 20th century, and indeed the consequences of 9/11, and the exact opposite consequences have been drawn by the American government and sadly by the British government, to say we must use maximum military force to try to kill it. But you can't kill ideas with maximum military force. The idea has already come to a tragic non-conclusion in Iraq, where a bad situation has been turned into an infinitely worse situation by the use of crude force of the old-fashioned military type. And of course, the one, as it were, festering wound that is at the heart of the anger of the Islamic world is the presence of Israel. I think 9/11, we can't prove this, of course, but it is certainly my assumption that 9/11 and the present degree of Islamic anger on the part of a significant minority of Muslims is caused by Western policy towards the Middle East, and more specifically by the type of society that Israel has become, in fact a militarized colony virtually of the United States. I don't think this is remotely like the wonderful humanist ideals that lay behind so much of the dream of creating a humane Jewish society. And what has happened instead is that it has become a beleaguered successor to the Jewish ghettos in Russia. It is a society which sees itself as a ghetto within the Middle East, that needs to protect itself with high walls, and that can only really survive with a protecting power outside. And for the moment, that protecting power is the United States. But if that protection is withdrawn, then the way Israel runs its affairs means that the Islamic world one day will be powerful enough to cause another Holocaust, to murder many, many, many more millions of Jews. And so, with my own Jewish background, I just weep that at the heart of today's political tragedy, global tragedy, lies this little beleaguered country, desperately fighting for its survival in all the wrong ways. And I want it to survive. I don't think the way it was established is a help in the process, but it's there. And you can't undo history. And being there, it only has a future in friendship with the Islamic world. It has no future in any other way. And to, as it were, adopt aggressive policies backed by foreign imperialism, the new imperialism of America, which sadly the British government supports. God knows where that will lead.
Part of the problem there, and I wonder what you knew, how would you agree with this, is the fact that so many Islamic states do not recognise the state of Israel. Is that, part of this sort of neurosis and the perception of the need always to be assertive, stroke aggressive?
Well, I think the reality is that at least half the Arabs, Islamic states in the Middle East, tacitly do recognize Israel. And in fact, they have very little support to the Palestinian people. There is no doubt that Egypt and Jordan and Saudi Arabia have been bought by American power. And the more important thing here is that all the Arab states in the so-called Cairo Declaration have made quite plain that if Israel were willing to exist within the boundaries set by the United Nations, if Israel were willing to let even a small proportion of the Arab, of the Palestinian refugees return, if Israel were prepared to share Jerusalem as a joint capital of two countries, under those conditions, the whole Arab world has already agreed to recognize Israel within its legal boundaries. But this is the very thing Israel refuses to bargain about. Having planted so many colonies within the very small area that would be the state of Palestine, that makes that state now not viable. There is no solution on the horizon. But a different Israeli policy would now almost certainly lead to a general recognition of Israel by the whole Arab world. It's the inability of Israel to see that in its own interests it's got to do this or remain in a permanent war situation.
Do you think this recent war, I think one can call it a war in Lebanon, and the performance of the Hezbollah will make a difference? Is that a sort of warning?
Is that public opinion in Israel, in other words, the majority of Israelis, is so militarized in its ideology and in its attitudes that the success of the relative success of Hezbollah in being able to stand up to the Israeli military for a few weeks, rather than leading to a rethink in Israel, is simply making most Israelis say, our government was too weak, our government didn't fight hard enough, we should have killed them all much more quickly. In other words, the hawks and not the doves are the winners of this somewhat unsatisfactory military action. And the government is being blamed for not being hawkish enough and taking too much notice of foreign opinion. So I think this is very personal now. I can only see my own Jewish background as leading me to say my solidarity is with the 5% of Israelis, and that's what the statistics seem to indicate, who share my unhappiness at all this, the conscientious objectors and the military forces who are now saying we're not going to fight for this kind of Israel. The extraordinary nature of Israeli society is illustrated by the fact that one of those who are in total opposition to this policy is the Prime Minister's own son. And a lot of young men who refuse to go along with this come from very traditional military families, and they've recognized that this is not the way forward, but it's 5%. It's a very, it's about the size of the number of Germans who during the Second World War were in their heart of hearts against Hitler. But it was only 5%. The majority of Germans, 95%, fought this war to the bitter end with total dedication. And how Israeli opinion and the opinion of world Jewry can be changed, because the majority of Jews regard any criticism of Israel as proof of anti-Semitism. And I think, of course, that that's nonsense. It's a form of blackmail. It's, if you criticize Israel, we'll call you an anti-Semite. That's moral blackmail, because it's not true. But even though it's not true, it is true for most Jews. That is how they feel. It's part of the reality that we've got to deal with. Criticize Israel, and immediately most Jews will say, well, this is the old anti-Semitism, there you are, nothing's changed. So in the old days we went like sheep to the slaughter. Now at least if we die, we'll die, and our boys will be sitting in tanks. So I can understand this. It's perhaps a very human reaction, but it's so counterproductive and tragic.
Are you ever accused of anti-Semitism?
Oh, yes.
Given your views?
Yes, I mean, the views I have just expressed. I published in an article in The Guardian a few months ago. And, I got, within a week, I had more than 500 responses on my email. And a significant number of them simply said, well, you know, if there's some Jewish blood in you, it's the old Jewish self-hatred coming out. You just hate Jews, don't you? And, you know, lots of that, lots of people reacted in that kind of way.
So this partly answers my next question, you know, or the individual part of it, you know, what is being done by the church and people like yourself to try and remedy this situation? What can be done?
Well, of course, the church, as though it were a definable entity in the world, doesn't exist, of course. Christians throughout history have disagreed with each other deeply about almost every conceivable thing. And a Christian pacifist like me, who really thinks that Jesus took away our right to kill others for our beliefs, you know, we're a very small minority within the Christian world, if there is such a thing. The church corporately has learnt a lot about human rights, which it used to oppose. The idea of human rights is a totally secular thing, which for a long time Christians resisted the idea of human rights. Tried to impose their views on people. Well, that lesson's been learned. All the churches in their official guise preach human rights as though they'd also always done so, which is of course not the case. Yet what I would call liberal, open and humane Christianity is almost on the retreat, and in a way comparable to Islamic and Jewish fundamentalism, you get a growth of Christian fundamentalism, of a kind of intolerant Christianity that at its best is not a threat to anyone. It's a very sort of personalised religion that doesn't get involved in the world and doesn't get involved in politics, as though Christianity was just about saving your individual soul. This version of Christianity is escapist, doesn't accept that the whole good Jewish and Christian tradition is about creating the world and turning it into the kingdom of God, turning it into a different kind of world. That sort of Christianity at the moment has its back against the wall. And the worst kind of fundamentalism, of course, allies itself now with Israel, with a weird theology saying we are near the apocalyptic end days, and a great battle of Armageddon will be fought, and the few of us who love Jesus, along with the Jewish people who will come to love Jesus in the last at the last moment, will all be saved, and the rest of the world will go to hell. An extraordinary aberration, but they really believe it. They passionately believe it. So when you ask me, what does the church say to all this? There's no such thing as the church. There are, sadly, completely incompatible views with each other within Christendom. And a humane Christian faith that wants to ally with all other people because they're human beings and God loves all human beings. That sort of Christianity, of course, I hope in the end will break through and be seen to be the truth, or somewhere near the truth, because we can never finally define truth. We're not God. And, of course, every fundamentalism acts as though it was God. In other words, I'm not very optimistic about the role of the church in the world today. Not optimistic, but I've not lost hope. So I always say I'm a hopeful pessimist.
But you obviously are still putting forward your views about these things, aren't you, Paul? Because I know you write articles and you're on the radio talking.
Well, I'm on the radio talking a lot less than I used to be, but I certainly go on writing, I go on thinking, I go on praying. And I think one of my ways of witnessing and answering your question about church personally is that, you know, relatively late in life, as almost a kind of public demonstration, I didn't just go on being an Anglican priest. I decided also to be a Quaker, which is actually going back to my parents, who became Quakers in New Zealand. Quakerism has been something that in a way has been present within me at the back of my conscience, as it were, all the time. But I came to see that this small... I always think of the Quakers as an order within Christianity, like the Roman Catholic Church has orders like Jesuits and Franciscans and so on. And so Christendom has small groups who witness to particular truths. And I think the Quakers have always been a small group since the days of the Reformation. And they've never tried to be a mass movement. They are people who believe in the freedom of the human conscience, and they don't have any particular doctrines. But one of the things most Quakers have in common, I always have to say most because they don't impose anything on their members, but most Quakers are pacifists. In other words, the peace witness is at the heart of being a Quaker, saying, you know, we will not agree that there is any cause that justifies going to war against other people, other nations, other religions, or whatever. And who practice their faith. Yes, as their official title is, of course, the Religious Society of Friends.